So today we're looking at the second chapter of Philippians in a series of looking at Philippians in four chapters. For those of you who weren't here or didn't follow up in January, we looked at the first chapter. We looked at a bit about where Philippi was, who the community was, where Paul was writing from prison, and some of the ideas he introduced. I just wanted to pick up a few things. Quite a lot of people afterwards spoke to me about reasons that I find Paul tricky, and quite a lot of people afterwards came up and said the thing I'd missed off the list is that you are offended by being expected to take Jesus and Paul at the same level. That it's all very well that Paul's good to listen to, but that it's not Jesus. And so I just wanted to take that up and just talk about that a little bit before we launch into the second chapter. The first thing is to say that Paul himself would be absolutely appalled at that, absolutely outraged to have anyone consider him equal to Jesus. He was always and first and identified by being a servant of Christ. He was never a competitor with Christ. And it would have just gone to the core of his being if he'd thought that was happening. But we also need to know that we don't actually have the words of Jesus from Jesus. Jesus never wrote a book. In fact, Jesus was almost certainly illiterate, which in our book-loving culture is really hard to take, but carpenters didn't learn to read. He was a scholar of the scriptures, but they were passed on orally, so he would not have probably been able to read them. So we have the words and the actions of Jesus as they were remembered and passed on and valued by communities of believers after Jesus' death. And they're written in response to the specific needs of communities, recipient audiences of those gospels, probably 35 to 60 years after Jesus' death. Paul is earlier than that. Probably all the letters that we've got that Paul actually wrote himself are written before any of the Gospels. If not all of them, definitely Galatians and the first one of Thessalonians are written before the Gospels. Philippians depends a bit on which prison you think Paul's writing from. If he's writing from Ephesus, then it's earlier than all the Gospels. If he's writing from Rome, then it's probably around the same time as the Gospel of Mark. In this chapter, we've got a piece that's probably even earlier than that, that Paul has used coming out of his culture, out of his Christian experience and put into his letter. So in Paul, we've got an earlier record than the Gospels of what the life and teachings of Jesus meant for early believers. He doesn't give us the life or teachings of Jesus, but he gives us the sense of how it impacted and what it meant for how they lived. Again, for specific communities with specific needs in a specific time, but probably 20 to 30 years after the death of Jesus. So, because there's so much packed into chapter 2 of Philippians, I'm going to first have a look at the bit that everyone talks about, and then I'll talk about how that fits into the rest. The bit that everyone talks about is the bit Paul wrote the song about. The what's sometimes called the Christ hymn. If you're following along in a Bible, it's verses 6 to 11. There's a couple more Bibles here if anyone wants to follow, because there's so much in it today. So first I'm going to talk about verses 6 to 11, and then I'll put that in the context of the whole chapter. So verses 6 to 11 are almost certainly pre-Paul. Somebody else wrote them, and Paul has used them. They're probably a liturgical piece, possibly a song, possibly a hymn, definitely a poetic utterance. And they express some of the core early understandings of what the church thought about Jesus, who they thought he was, what they thought he was like. It's probably one of the earliest written pieces of Christian tradition that we have, these six verses. And therefore, there is voluminous study on them. There's more written about these six verses than the rest of Philippians combined. It's quite overwhelming, to be honest. And it, Paul presents it, he doesn't argue it, he just presents it, which gives the sense that this is an assumed understanding between the people he's talking to, that he assumes that he and they share this sense of God, which means it's really good evidence then of what the church held as their core beliefs, because it's not something Paul's arguing for, it's something he's just knowing, we all think this, therefore, he's got a therefore out of it. So if you're a limited listener today and you can only take small bits, just let this roll around. Jesus, though equal with God, let go of it all, poured himself out as a complete nobody, all for the needs of others and the servants' service of God. And this is the Jesus you're following. So the first half of that, Jesus could have had it all and didn't. The first half is all about going down. And it has two really tricky Greek words in there. So I'm going to talk about Greek, sorry. Because how you understand what those Greek words mean changes what this verse means. So there's this lovely irony here that we have this core piece of early Christian teaching that expresses what they thought of Jesus, but the words are so hard to grasp that we don't know what it is. So thanks. The first word is morphe. Jesus being in the morphe of God, in the, it's usually translated the form of God. But what does that mean? What is the form of God? Is this a likeness? Is this the essence of God? Does he look like God? Or is he actually God? Is he made of the same stuff as God? We use the word form sometimes in the words we use the word mould. If you are making statues, you pour stuff into the form and that creates the thing, the reverse. So if you have the same form, you can fill it up with chocolate or concrete and it's got the same form, but it's got a completely different substance. So is that what we're talking about? Something that's the same form in that sense of God, but a different substance? Or is it that it's within something of God? Something like saying it's a chip off the old block is a similar kind of expression, possibly. To make it trickier, Greek has about five words that kind of overlap in this area that means nearly the same thing and not quite. You've got essence, you've got a changeable exterior, you've got image, which covers a lot, you've got likeness, and they're all sort of overlapping. And Paul, in the rest of the chapter, uses a couple of the other ones, possibly just because, you know, when you're writing, you don't use the same word all the time, not because you mean three different things, because it gets boring if you use the same one. For me, I think the most important, most helpful thing I read about this was from Dennis Ham, who said the whole gist of it, however we take it, is not about metaphysics. It's about social status. Jesus had the morphe of God, and it's expressing something of his social status, his universal status. The next tricky word is harpagmos. Jesus, having the morphe of God, did not consider equality with God harpagmos. So the word is actually very rarely used in any Greek we've got. So we haven't got comparable examples. And where we do have it, it means robbery. Harpagmos. Sorry, Bevan. Harpagmos. So it's a very unusual word. Related words give it a sense of to grasp, to seize, but we don't really know for sure what Paul meant. And all the meanings we can kind of guess at can be read either as to snatch at something you don't yet have that's not yours, or to cling tight to something that you do have, and to use it selfishly, the thing you're hanging on to. So if the word being used here means to grab at something you don't have, then that gives us an interpretation of who Jesus is that's more likely to say he's an ordinary human being and he's being affirmed here for not trying to be like God. But if it's the latter, if it's a word about not hanging on to something you've already got, then we've got an expression possibly looking at Jesus as being something like divine who chose not to act divine, to let that go. Now you can see why this volume's written. This is only two words, and that can change the whole nature of how we've based our Christian faith. This is why we learn Greek, and this is why we regret learning Greek. They're very excited in the back, right? Good, good. Makes me a little bit nervous when those two are excited. Probably the whole piece is paralleling Jesus compared with Adam, is what all the commentators say. And I said, what about Eve? So I'm going to compare Jesus with Adam and Eve. Although Eve doesn't come out very well in this comparison. Adam and Eve were given two trees not to eat from, and they ate them because they wanted to be like God. Now, we could have a story here that's replaying this human makes a choice story with Jesus making the opposite choice. Another human comes, is given the choice to be like God and says no. Or we could have a story where the parallel is that Adam and Eve grasped at something they had no right to have. Jesus, who was divine, had it already and chose not to keep it. So it works either way. That doesn't actually help us know if Paul's trying to tell us that he thought Jesus was divine or not. But I think the contrast with how humans chose to respond to the issues of status and power and godlikeness and how Jesus responded remain, regardless of the inner essence of the metaphysics of Jesus. Have I lost anyone yet? I'm only two words in and I've got a whole chapter. So, the first three verses of this ancient hymn, I'm going to call it a hymn, although there's, it could be various things, but hymn, poem, have a downward descent. Jesus emptied himself. Now, there's a sideline. What did he empty himself of? Because certain theologies of Jesus pick up that he emptied himself of certain characteristics of God, and therefore he was a special God thing that could be human in a way because he wasn't being, like, omnipotent, for example. He wasn't able to know everything and see everything. Mostly that's not actually very helpful, so let it go. It's probably more of an expression, an idiom for he made himself nothing, he poured himself out. Both of those, if you translate either of those literally from English, that's very hard. So I think the concept is so hard that the language becomes poetic. He emptied himself, he took the morphe, same word again, of a slave. He became a human, but even humbler, he became a dead human. But even more humble, he became a shamefully dead human by choosing the cross, or by allowing the cross. So in three verses, you have moved from equality with God to nothing. You've moved from privilege and power to being a powerless outcast. And it's possible this is to contrast with the Greek and Roman gods who used power selfishly or capriciously, that this is a new kind of understanding of what it means to be God. And then it turns. In verse 9, it turns, the grammar turns so that Jesus is no longer the subject of the sentence. God becomes the subject of the sentence. So all the downward action, Jesus is the doer. All the upward action, God is the doer. Which is important to me because it means Jesus is never depicted as having got to the bottom and gone, right, well, that's enough of that. I'll go back up now. He's depicted as just going to the bottom. And it is God who says, I will take you from there and raise you up. Literally, in terms of his life, raise him up out of death, but raise him up in status also. To become the name above all names. What name is it that's above all names? In a Jewish context, there's only one name above all names. The name you can't spell and mustn't say, which in Greek is written as Kurios, Lord. So he's here described as Lord Jesus Christ. This is a remarkable claim if this is what's being said here, to give him the name above all names. Or it could mean that from this point on, that this point being the resurrection in this case, from the point of the resurrection, from God raising him, the very ordinary human name Jesus, which was just a name people gave their kids, will become held as the most important name ever. And perhaps it's a combination of the two. We are talking about a mystery of divine and human incarnation here. Next major theological question enters six tomes. Is he raised back to where he started, or does he go up to somewhere he never was? And again, it's argued, plausibly argued both ways. I'm not going to tell you which one I think is more true today. I'm sorry. I'm giving you, this is the mystery of difficulty that we wrestle with in one of our core texts. This text is in the top 10 of texts from the New Testament. It's up there on the hit list. I'll get to that. Thank you. For the tape, Elisa's struggling to know why we should care. It is possible that when it says he's raised up, that he's both back somewhere he started and also somewhere he never was. That he's both returned to a sense of the divine, the power, the status, and also brought to it his experience of being human, so that that will never be the same again. A new dimension of the divine reality. It ends by saying everyone will acknowledge, everyone in all the layers and dimensions of reality will acknowledge Jesus Christ as Lord. This is the basic declaration of Christian faith at the time. The equivalent of the Jesus prayer. You'll note there's nobody has to say they're a dreadful sinner in order to be a Christian. They need to say Jesus Christ is Lord. That's the creed. And there's a vision here that eventually everyone will recognise this. Every knee will bow. Does this mean God is going to be kneecapping people to make sure they're appropriately on their knees? Was anyone raised in a Christian tradition with air of this? Worship Jesus or else. There's some nods. Or is it that Jesus is just so amazing, so glorified, big, that you'll just be gobsmacked. At some point, it'll be like turning the corner after sunset where you come over a rise where the sun hasn't quite set yet and you turn and there's that, the sky's on fire and you just have nothing to say. Or is it because it's his lowliness that is so incredible? But it's so incredible, it's invisible. The loneliness makes it impossible to see, and therefore God lifts up the lowliness so that it's his humility, not his glory, that we can see and give praise for. I have a cheeky thought, it's probably just over there, that every knee will bend, not because God is so wonderful and big that we can't bear it, but because we discover that that's where God is. It's like you can't talk to a two-year-old if you're standing up proud, that you'll have to go down in the dirt to be with God, and that's the God we've just had revealed. He went down and down and down, and God will say, every knee will bow, because that's where you'll find God. Like Lunig's talking to a duck. Now, when I wrote my notes, I put that in, and then I took it out, because I thought, it's offensive to talk about Jesus as a duck. It felt offensive to me to talk about Jesus as a duck. But then I put it back in because I thought maybe that's the point, actually, that this sort of Jesus, this completely devoid of status, there's nothing less status-like in our culture than a duck. This, our sense of offence, is our sense that this is not how the world and God should work. And yet, we've just had these key verses saying this is how God works. So I'll leave my duck in the corner for you to think about. I could be wrong about the duck. And just in case all of this casts in doubt the core Hebrew belief that there is only one God, it ends by saying all of this will be for God's glory. Not for Jesus' glory. I think some worship songs have missed that point. For God's glory. And the piece, especially the end bit about the glory, very strongly parallels Isaiah chapter 45, which is a real strong affirmation of the oneness of God, that says no knee will bow or tongue confess anything but Yahweh, the one God. The very language is used here for Jesus. So it's both affirming the one godness of God and somehow adding new aspects to that. So by ending with Jesus Christ is Lord, it suggests that this may be creedal, that this statement is an essence of the Christian faith. What led them to consider Jesus of Nazareth to be both Christ, the Jewish Messiah, and Lord Yahweh, the one God? What led them to that conclusion? Humility, selfless love, renunciation of status and privilege. And the resurrection always is core to how they constructed theology. The resurrection was interpreted as God saying yes to this life of Jesus. So there's a lot to chew on in there. That's the important bit in inverted commas. But I actually don't think any of that is what Paul is writing about in the second chapter of Philippians. Sorry. Lots in there are our concerns. Not Elise's, clearly, but others. Sorry to put you on the spot, Elise. So let's go back and have a look at where it fits in. John started at the end of chapter 1, because it does. The section really starts just at the end of chapter 1 at 127 and goes on. It picks up where Paul's talking about unity, suffering, and the centrality of living so the gospel can be seen by the people around you. And he starts chapter 2 by saying, let Christ motivate you. Do you let Christ motivate you? There's a thought if you're only listening to bits. Be of one heart, one mind, one love. Be humble. Don't be jealous or vain. Don't be selfish. Put others first. And Paul both affirms that they're already doing these things and have been doing these things, and also urges them to keep on being dedicated to these things. What does this call you to today? Be of one heart, one mind, one love. Be humble, be not jealous or vain, not selfish, but put others first. Be of a single mind. Does this mean we're not to think for ourselves? It's about conformity. Stephen Fowle usefully said, this is calling for an ordered, harmonious diversity, where having the right mind is not a specific dictum, but an attitude of humility and selflessness. I'm going to use those words so many times, you want to strike them out. And we can agree on that, on an attitude of humility and selflessness, without having to agree on the same way for all of us to live it out. Imitating someone doesn't mean copying every detail of them. If I want to live like Mother Teresa, I don't have to wear blue and white and join the Sisters of Charity. Missionaries of Charity? The Charities, whoever they are. I found a really helpful understanding of humility in Gordon Fee, who writes that humility is not self-focused. In other words, it's not about focusing on myself and making myself smaller. That's not humility. It's other-focused, and not focused on making them bigger, because that's still implicitly about making myself smaller. It's focused on the needs of others, so that their needs become the thing that runs, guides me, and how big or small I am in that picture ceases to be relevant to who I am. Make your mind the mind of Christ. It's a repeat theme right through Philippians. It's about right thinking, the right mind. Have it right about your mind. So here it's about, copy Jesus' attitude. Or it could be translated something more like, because you are in Christ, remember that you have his mind. In some ways it's the same trick of language that we had earlier on about, is it something you already have to hold on to or something that you're trying to get to? And you can translate this either way too. Probably the Greek leans more towards it being something, the mind of Christ being something you already have. More about a reminder of the soil you're growing out of than a command to copy a historical figure. So these events of the Christ hymn that we've just looked at, these are the things that made them who they are, that make us who we are. Paul uses the Christ hymn to talk about how to be unified, how to live in suffering. So he's referring back to where it comes from. It comes from Jesus. That's how we know, how we're strengthened to be unified, to live in suffering. You might remember from last time I spoke that Philippi was a particularly status-obsessed community and culture. We've got archaeological evidence for that. So into that culture, how much more, if Christ renounced the ultimate status, how much more are your claims to power or privilege to be let go? God does not value you based on your achievements or your power, your employment or your role, your title, your inheritance, your property, your social recognition. It's also an affirmation of the countercultural life of the Philippians who have chosen to do this. It's likely that it was a civic virtue in Philippi to be part of the emperor cult. And so to be a Christian then is to be politically suspect and probably socially outcast, possibly even law-breaking. And this affirms that, yes, you're on the right track, that getting rid of your status, not bowing to the status of the emperor, that's the right track. The section about going up again, there's no expectation that we're meant to be imitating that, that we're meant to be then lifting ourselves back up again. It's a promise, I suppose, that God will honour those who serve, but more importantly, the section about God lifting Jesus up is an affirmation of God's choice, of Jesus' choice, and it reveals the essential nature of God. If this is what God values above all, Jesus will be raised above all, then it tells us who God is, unselfish, committed to the well-being of others, disinterested in power for power's sake. And then following that liturgical piece, Paul says, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. Now that's a tricky piece. It's particularly tricky if salvation means avoiding hell after you die. And it's particularly tricky if work it out is a command to you as an individual person. Then there is plenty of fear and trembling, because then it's about working very hard to ensure I don't go to hell. Well, for me. Yeah. But all of this passage is in the plural. It's addressed to a community that's been called to unity. And salvation is not just about the end times. Salvation is about health and about healing. Our salvation, the work of Jesus in saving us, was to bring us into relationship with God. So our salvation is our relationship with God. And that requires work, because relationships are not a fixed point in time that happened and is done. Entering into a relationship, then we've got a relationship. So salvation brings us into relationship with God, and then we work on being in relationship. I think this is what it means to say work out your salvation is about working out what it means to be in relationship with God, not just any God, but this selfless God who doesn't want to do power. And you're not called to do this alone, but addressed as a community. Mount Hawthorne Community Church. Work out together our ongoing salve, our ongoing healing and restoration that God is working in us as a group and is continuing to work in us and through us as a group. So growth in holiness is not a personal thing. We grow more holy, more like Christ, in the spaces between us, not in any one of us. Brother Christopher Jamieson, the Benedictine abbot from the UK, he says, we get to heaven together or not at all. We get to heaven together or not at all. Not because heaven is out there and we need to all hold hands or we won't make it, but because it is in the togethering that heaven arises. So the fear and trembling, I think, is the awe and wonder of being in relationship with real people. Because you can't walk in with brassy confidence and a sense of my right to be here and my ability to succeed into a communal work of working out our relationship with God. We can only succeed in that if we come as humble people. And in case that seems enormous, verse 13 very clearly says it is God who both motivates you to this and empowers you to do it. Why? It says specifically, just because God is generous. Chapter 2, verse 14 is possibly the key reason the Philippians got this letter. Paul's chief concern, the big issue in Philippi, grumbling. If you're only listening to small bits, listen to this, because Paul thought this was the most important bit. It doesn't seem such a biggie to me, but it earned the Philippians a concerned letter from Paul from prison. It was clearly perceived as potentially hampering both their salvation relationship work and their witness to the community around them. Now, I have to confess that I'm a grumbler. It's a great weakness of mine, and I need to hear this caution. If I'm making eye contact with you at this point, it's not because I think you're also a grumbler, and it's not because I think I've said nasty things about you, but I have said nasty things about people in this church. Just look at everyone now so that nobody thinks I'm joking at them. It's a matter of church health and life, and I apologise. When I feel like bitching about someone, especially someone here at Mount Hawthorn, within our church family, how can I draw on the empowering mind of Christ instead of my selfish sense of a right to complain? And then Paul goes on to talk about why he thinks that's important. Two main reasons. One, so that the Philippians will be a light in the dark, dark world of Philippi. There's some very dark, dark world language used there. So it's real Old Testament dark language. Both a light that is a beacon for people to look to and a light that shines into the darkness and makes it less dark. And the second reason is so that Paul's work will be fulfilled. There's a sense of a proud parent hoping children will grow to adulthood and they can say, oh, thank goodness it was worth it. Now, this is recurred in verse 2. We also had Paul talking about, do this to make me happy. Now, to me, this sounds like a strange motivation. It's kind of a bit dependent and a bit manipulative. But it appears in his culture it was not. So I think I just have to leave it there, because he's not asking me to make him happy. He's talking to his dear friends in Philippi nearly 2,000 years ago. So if that's what was important to motivate them, let him be. The last section of the chapter can feel like a tag-on. Could be just practicalities, plans. After all, this is a letter, not a theological treatise. He's talking about Timothy and Epaphroditus. But I think it's more crafted than that. I think this is written as further examples of the humility and service to which the Philippians are being urged. So we've got four examples. First, we had Paul in chapter 1, suffering in prison for the gospel, and there seeing opportunities in the way he lived in prison to be a light shining, a witness to the nature of Christ. And then we've had Christ, the ultimate example, who could have been a thumping ruler and instead chose to be a nobody Galilean, executed in a culturally shameful way. So the third example is Timothy. Timothy learnt from Paul. He companioned him. He served alongside him. And Paul says, he shares my heart. He's a man who loves the Philippians. But he was with Paul when they together founded the church in Philippi on a missionary journey. He's a man who cares for the Philippians' well-being above his own, and he has a proven track record of selflessness. Proven that he follows Christ by being selfless. So there's Timothy, who is Paul is going to send them Timothy soon as he can, soon as he's got his own prison thing sorted out, and Timothy can come and tell him how it went. And then we have Epaphroditus, who is from Philippi. He's been sent by the Philippians to Paul to help him in prison. He's been sent with a gift, probably money. The intent, it seems, was that he would come and accompany Paul in prison, because as we talked about last time, Roman prisons are terrible, terrible places to be, and you didn't get fed properly if you didn't have a friend. But probably on the way, or soon after he got there, he got so sick he nearly died. And it's only by a miracle of grace that he's alive. And he misses the Philippians terribly. And he's very concerned because he knows they've heard he's sick and they probably haven't yet heard that he survived. So he's worried that they're worrying. His concern is first for the gospel, second for Paul, third for the Philippians, and maybe fourth for himself. He's held up as the model of how to live out this Christ life. It's important to know he's spoken of as one who is keen in supporting the gospel in Paul, always means the missionary gospel, evangelism, telling other people. But Epaphroditus is not a teller of other people. His job is to bring a whole lot of money and food and come and be with Paul and give it to him. Now, I think there's some people in our community who are much better at bringing food and being alongside people than telling anyone about Jesus. So hear this for you, that he is called a missionary of the gospel. And Paul says you must hold up very highly people like this. He's acknowledged as someone spreading the good news, even if it doesn't come out his mouth, because he supports the ones who speak it and because of his attitude in whatever it is he's doing, especially in his suffering. And Paul goes to great lengths to ensure that Epaphroditus is warmly welcomed home. Now, you could read this straight, that Paul is so overjoyed that he survived that he's just full of praise for him and sends him home. Or it could be read that there's some tension at home in Philippi. Maybe the fact that he's got sick, maybe people are wondering if he's failed the mission. Maybe they're thinking he should have stayed longer. Maybe Paul's anticipating that he'll come home and people will think Paul's rejected their offer of support. But it's a loving, lovely touch of humanity. Paul recognises Epaphroditus' need. He needs to go home. He's sad. He wants to be with his people. And Paul affirms this and sends him home. So this selfless life is not all about humiliating yourself and burning out. It could be just a coincidence, but it could be a tacit corrective to the possible misreading of what he's just said. This over-dogmatic allegiance to selflessness that leads to damaging yourself. Epaphroditus had that choice and Paul said, no, go home. Go home to your people. You're sad. So here's my summary of Philippians chapter 2. It's not just, here's the example, people, go and do likewise. It's more of a you plural. You plural are embedded into the upside-down trajectory of Jesus. This divine human mind is at work in you, plural, enabling you. So live like it. And let others see the thing that attracted you in the first place, the astonishing emptying of Jesus to be a nobody, through whom God restored relationship with you, you, plural. Be united in thinking of the needs of others first. Does this sound too hard? Well, look at Timothy. Look to Epaphroditus. Look to Paul. We're all in it together having a go. Look to Christ. Not only is he the ultimate example, but he's the measure of what matters to God. And through our identity in Christ, God's enabling strengths makes this life of unity, humility, and selflessness, this strength makes it actually possible. Does anyone want to say anything?
got me thinking with that comment about Paul saying, if you do this, you'll make me happy. But I think under the circumstances, Paul, as you pointed out last time, was having a pretty rough time in prison, and people would think that the most important thing to him would be to get out. Mm. So maybe he's using it to say, no, the most important thing to me isn't to get out, it's to hear that you're doing well. Mm. Yep. So to reinforce what he's said above.
Yes, I think that's true. Good observation. About the whole point of the Christ hymn, it's this is the way you are to live, like Christ, and the reason you can do it is because this same Christ is what's within you. Is that a summary enough? Yeah.
There's been a huge mob of stuff you've given us, and the one that sitting there lovely on top at the moment for me is, Paul wasn't concerned about their theology so much. He was concerned about them just
leaving. It was flashing. I think it's gone. Battery's gone.
That they were grumbling. Yeah. You know, and that it wasn't some sort of highfalutin. Oh, no, you're not interpreting scriptures correctly. It was they were grumbling amongst each other. I like that.
Yeah. For the tape, Ken was saying the most important thing was not their theology, but their grumbling.